But today I'm delighted to welcome Professor Chris Adam, Professor of Development Economics and a Senior Oxford Martin Fellow on the Oxford Martin Programme on African Governance. Now, Chris also, happily for us, is an Associate Editor of the Oxford Review of Economic Policy. And as of next year, we're delighted to say we'll be stepping into the shoes of the Managing Editor. Now, this is no slight on the existing Managing Editor who has tried to do his best, but let me just say we're all very much looking forward to Chris taking over. Yesterday, David noted that many countries simply don't have the fiscal firepower to throw trillions at the pandemic. And many of those countries without that firepower are in sub-Saharan Africa. And what are they to do? Well, I'm hoping that today we'll get some sense of the policy landscape and the set of options for these countries where actually, if anything, the severity of the pandemic hasn't been as obviously severe yet as it has been in some other countries, but where I think, at least speaking personally, it seems to me the risks could be all the more severe. So hopefully Chris will take us through some of those policy options in low-income countries, in particular in sub-Saharan Africa, or at least in a representative country. And Chris, if you could spend 15 or 20 minutes sharing the ideas in your paper in the Oxford Review, we'll then turn to Q&A. And those listening in, you can ask questions at the bottom right of your screen, and you can upvote questions you like. And as you've seen in previous sessions, at a certain point, I can't ignore a question that's been upvoted. Enough. So do ask questions. So Chris, the floor is yours. Thank you.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Cameron, and thank you for the invitation to speak in this series this afternoon. You made a couple of points, which I think I will use as my jumping off points for my opening remarks. The first is that what I'm going to talk about today follows on to some quite substantial degree from the presentation that David Vines made yesterday and the paper that he and Warwick McKibben have written about global fiscal coordination. In a sense, what I'm going to talk about is a slightly deeper dive into the analytics of one group of countries, those that don't have the fiscal firepower that, say, the advanced economies might have. And I want to talk through some work we've done on trying to think through the structure of the COVID-19 shock to sub-Saharan Africa and some policy options. The second point I want to pick up on that Cameron started with is the observation that, in a sense, global attention has been rather naturally on the global hotspots, the United States, Europe, increasingly Latin America of late, and that in some sense, there's been much less attention on sub-Saharan Africa and the low-income countries, sub-Saharan Africa. And on one level, in a very direct sense, this is understandable. We're talking about a region of the world with a population of about 1 billion people with, at present, a relatively low case count and a really very low recorded fatality rate. The latest numbers might suggest something in the region of 15,000 COVID-related deaths so far. We need to be very, very careful about numbers here, and I'll come back to that in a moment. But to some extent, for the low-income countries of sub-Saharan Africa, the challenges are all indirect. That even if we were in a situation where, for a variety of epidemiological reasons, the pandemic itself had no direct or very limited direct effect on the countries in the continent, or that lockdown measures or social distancing measures or other public health interventions were supremely effective, that would not insulate the economy from the indirect effects of the pandemic. And what I want to argue in this paper and what we try and show is that it is the indirect spillover effects from the global economy that are likely to present the biggest challenge and the biggest threat to the low-income countries of sub-Saharan Africa. And without being over-dramatic, it's probably fair to say that what's at stake here is essentially 25 years plus of progress in terms of human development on the continent. That whilst there's an awful lot of variety from across countries. There are countries still very much mired in conflict. But compared to, say, the 1980s or early 90s, the economies of sub-Saharan Africa have had a really impressive quarter of century, 30 years of steady economic progress, some very high and sustained rates of growth, some very significant reductions in direct measures of poverty, but more broadly in terms of other measures of human development, inclusive measures of human development. There has been a lot of registered progress amongst the low-income countries of sub-Saharan Africa. A lot of this is at stake, at risk. And what I want to do then in my next 10 minutes or so is to talk through some of the analytical elements that are relevant here, and then use that as a jumping off point to think about policy options, both national and international. So I'm going to share a few slides, really just to try and highlight a few of the key points that I want to make in a few pictures, and stress one or two key analytical points that come out of the paper, and then I'll stop sharing slides and return to a more open discussion. So if you give me 1 second, I will share my screen.
And if you can manage it, Chris, in 1 second, you're doing well, certainly better than David managed yesterday.
Well, let's see how far I get. Okay, can you confirm that you can see this, Cameron?
Yep, global cases and population.
Okay, so this is my starting point, and two observations. This is looking at the first 3 or 4 months of the pandemic. The solid lines are cases, and I've highlighted the fact that globally the daily case load in sub-Saharan Africa is extremely low relative to other regions of the world. The dark line is Europe, the blue is North America. The bars come from this fantastic evidence that the Blavatnik school team have collected, which is looking at the severity of public policy responses, lockdown effects. And the dissonance here is that despite this low caseload, or maybe there is a causal link here, the intensity of lockdown in sub-Saharan Africa has been really substantial. And I'll say a word or two about what lockdown might mean and the implications of this in a moment. But most countries in sub-Saharan Africa implemented some form of lockdown, and in many cases an extremely aggressive form of lockdown, sustained for 50, 60, 70 days, and in some cases longer. And at least by the end of May, early June, these lockdown measures seem to be associated with relatively low caseload and relatively low direct COVID-related mortality. If I go to my next slide, however, this is taken from the Financial Times 2 days ago. And what we're beginning to see is a steady creeping up in the proportion of daily deaths by region. So somewhere in the region of 5% of global deaths are accounted for in sub-Saharan Africa at the moment. This is rising quite steadily. We've heard a number of quite worrying reports coming out of South Africa, one of the few countries that is able to measure excess deaths, and the excess death numbers from South Africa are beginning to look rather worrying. This suggests that the direct effects of the pandemic may well still be further down the road. We may not be completely confident that the lockdown measures have done much more than push the risk further down the road. But before I move on to the economic side of it, one important issue that emerges from the epidemiological and public health evidence is that, as in many other cases, the big risks are the indirect consequences. Direct mortality from COVID may be low, and that may reflect the demographics. This is a very young continent. But the indirect effects as a result of reduced health-seeking behavior, the the paring back of other forms of health intervention may actually be very large and very serious. Already we know that more than half the countries in sub-Saharan Africa have halted their immunization programs. That's a very worrying sign looking forward in terms of thinking about the indirect effects. But as I said at the beginning, even if this mortality rate is kept low and managed, the economic effects of the pandemic are likely to be extremely severe for the continent. And the way I like to think about this is that for the economies of sub-Saharan Africa in general, although there may be quite a lot of variation across countries, and we can come back to that later, this is both a right hook and a left hook. It's a domestic supply shock in the sense that the imposition of lockdown measures withdraws labor from the economy. It leads to the closure of key sectors in both the tradable economy and the domestic economy. It reduces the efficiency of operations, the efficiency or increases the cost of operations. And that is a classic domestic shock, very similar to that experienced in other countries around the world. But the bigger part of the challenge for low-income countries is the spillover from the global recession. So it's a global demand shock. And the key point that I would stress here is that there may be a hit to output, to the productive side of the economy, but the big welfare costs come through the hit to the consumption or demand side of the economy. The small open economies of sub-Saharan Africa tend to operate with very large trade deficits. These trade deficits are financed partly through debt, but very importantly through remittances, through the inflow of foreign direct investment and other financial flows that allow consumption to be significantly higher than domestic production. The global demand shock for low-income countries is essentially can be thought of as an enforced closure of the balance of trade. So export earnings in many cases have fallen very dramatically, either for natural resource exporting economies, oil prices, mineral prices have dropped very substantially, the exception of course being gold. But for many other countries, think of those countries in East Africa, it's the reduction of travel and tourism that is removing a very substantial chunk from export earnings. The second major component is the slowdown in remittances. And many would argue that this the slowdown has only started as migrants are essentially trying to absorb some of the risk as they themselves may be protected by furlough schemes or other forms of support in the remitting countries. And the likelihood is that the decline in remittances that we've already seen will accelerate over the next 6 to 9 months. It's important to remember for many low-income countries, remittances now account for substantially more in terms of foreign flows than official aid flows. Then on the capital account, there's been a sudden stop, a freezing of private capital flows as investors seek the security of reinvesting back in, either they require the liquidity or seek the security of reinvesting back in the US. And FDI flows, including from major FDI originating countries, including China, have slowed very, very substantially. So this is the nature of the shock. And what we do in this paper is try and calibrate that shock for a representative low-income country. The numbers that we use actually come from Uganda, and in many respects, Uganda is archetypical, although clearly there's a lot of variation around these central numbers. And what we've done is shown in this picture. The dotted line is the pre-COVID trend per capita growth rate of consumption. And what we've done is using data and estimates, try to calibrate the impact of the shock. And here I've distinguished between the direct lockdown effects, which are initially very severe, but tail away quite quickly, the second round domestic effects, and then the global spillover effects. Faced with this kind of challenge, the question is, what are the policy options? And it's worth just drawing your attention to the scale of these kind of contractions. The squeeze to consumption could be in the order of 20-25% annualized and in the current year, and only recovering within 4 or 5 years, just from the current evidence we have on the severity of the global shock. The key challenge for low-income countries is this, that the mantra of we will do whatever it takes is a highly constrained mantra in low-income countries. Adjustment generally to external shocks, to falls in commodity prices, to natural disasters, to any form of external shock, is this one that you hear often: finance if you can, adjust if you must. And the finance if you can option is the bit that is extremely constrained. Anybody in the audience today who listened to David Vine's talk yesterday will have heard him refer to some numbers that came out of the IMF that suggest that amongst the major economies of the world, somewhere in the region of $9 to $10 trillion has been put forward either in direct or contingent financing to smooth adjustment. $9 to $10 trillion, that is getting on to 10% of global GDP. It's an enormous sum. Low-income countries do not have those resources. They have very limited foreign exchange reserves. They're not part of these deep and substantial central bank swap lines that provide short-term liquidity as required. They have very limited fiscal space. The recent history, the last 5 years, as commodity prices have fallen quite sharply from their peaks in around about 2015, has not been accompanied by an aggressive fiscal adjustment in most cases. And so the scope for domestic fiscal adjustment is highly constrained. And let me just sort of, before I say a little bit more about options, give you the conclusion of what we're looking at from this paper. That if you think about the kind of options that are feasible, that don't lead to excessive self-imposed damage, and I'll mention that in just a moment, we estimate from this analysis that low-income countries in sub-Saharan Africa might need an additional $40 to $50 billion of support in terms of balance of payments or budget support. Official financing, we think of this as official development assistance, $40 to $50 billion per annum over the next couple of years. That would entail about twice the current spending levels. It's extremely large in historical terms. It's not unprecedented, and that will be my closing remark, but it's also very small relative to the global scale. 40 to 50 billion is a small fraction of 10 trillion. But as I say, there's an awful lot at stake here. So let me say a word or two about what we do, and then I will stop sharing my slides. So what this paper does is it looks at a set of alternative fiscal macroeconomic and fiscal adjustments that are either blended with, that rely entirely on domestic financing options, or are blended with various amounts of overseas development or official development assistance, ODA. And what they allow us to do is to trace out alternative adjustment paths, ways in which we might imagine the economy adjusting in response to the fiscal measures and the path of the shock that I originally described. And the key thing, which is my penultimate point here, is that without external financing, there are clearly fiscal combinations that are feasible, but they're very costly. And they typically involve a combination of expenditure cuts, investment cutbacks, that really undermine the growth potential, the private sector growth potential over the medium term. So whereas one might get some improvement in some moderation of the shock in the short run, the consequences this green line shows is a much more attenuated recovery of the economy. This simply being because essentially the short run consumption gains are paid for by cannibalizing the medium term growth potential that is supported by productive public expenditures. Once you start to bring in external financing, then that recovery path is somewhat moderated and maybe further moderated, as we detail in the paper, if this financing is in some sense contingent on other forms of domestic fiscal reform. The final point on this slide that I want to make is simply that these numbers that I quoted earlier, the doubling of ODA, may make the fiscal adjustment feasible. It doesn't make it any less uncomfortable. That the amount of resources required to fully ensure consumption would be twice to 2.5 times the sum that I originally quoted, probably way beyond anything that is feasible, politically feasible. So let me just conclude with this final observation. This line is the path of development assistance since the 1960s, and the red dotted line is what our projections would suggest would be required from the levels currently prevailing just before the pandemic. This is a very substantial increase, this red dotted line, but I just draw your attention to one fact, that it's of the similar order of magnitude as the donors, the DAC donors. These are the traditional, essentially Western governments, provided in financing to finance the highly indebted Poor Countries Initiative between about 1998 and 2005. So it's not unprecedented. We're clearly in a different political configuration, but it helps us to scale the level of adjustment that might be required. So let me stop at that point and return to the screen. That sort of gives you a sense of both the positive, and we can talk a little bit more about the normative policy options that we described in the paper. But let me leave it at that point, Cameron, and then we can move.
Thanks, Chris. That was really a clear exposition of the issues, and I've learned something from it. I mean, I was really struck by your statement at the start that what is at stake is 25 years of progress on development. It's a big deal. And then the core conclusion that it's these indirect effects rather than the direct effects that may well come further down the road, but the indirect effects are the big ones. They're important conclusions, because it means, as you then kind of drew it all together, in a way it doesn't necessarily matter how well domestically African nations perform in their healthcare, in their response to the pandemic, if the rest of the world is suffering a demand shock. And it's going to be problematic for sub-Saharan Africa as well. That's a very important conclusion. Now, I've got a couple of questions before I turn to those that are coming in. I take the point that without external financing, it's going to be very challenging to make progress here. How do we make that external financing happen in a sensible way? I had this discussion with David yesterday. Many of the questions were about the scale of the challenge. How do we deliver what's required? And David's answer was more or less, well, we're not. We just have to do as much as we possibly can. But I wonder if there isn't a more optimistic angle here. You said that there's maybe 50 or 60 billion. It's not 10 trillion that is required. Yeah. David was saying, well, you're not going to get a trillion increase in capitalization or SDRs, the IMF. You know, you might get a few hundred billion, but even that was rejected. But we're not even talking about a few hundred billion. Is that right? Have I got that right? And is this feasible? Could it actually happen that we spare the poor countries the worst of the impacts if we were to be generous about it or sensible about it?
Yeah, I think this point about scale does matter. And you're right about the failed SDR issue in March of this year. That may not be completely off the table. The international organizations, the fund and its membership may be able to come back to that next year. There may be more room. It depends on a lot of factors, including the domestic politics of the United States, obviously. But this is operated in the past with a number of governments, particularly European governments, that they have essentially, through a generalized SDR issue from the fund, they have repurposed their share of the SDR allocation in terms of, it was reprogrammed towards debt relief in that 1998-2005 period by a number of countries. And there's plenty of discussion about that as an option. It is a difficult time to be talking about bilateral donor assistance. There's no question about it that we know only too well from our own country that the appetite is somewhat constrained. The kind of aid and development rhetoric is highly tarnished at present. And in particular, the kind of support that's required here, which is, roughly speaking, unconditional balance of payment support. It's basically providing the resources to allow governments to manage the fiscal adjustment process. I'm not sure how far I deviate from David's view that this is a difficult time to really push the bilateral donors. I think there's been quite a lot of action from the International Monetary Fund within the constraints that it operates, which are determined by quotas and various trust funds. But we've seen a lot of rapid response by the fund, more rapid than I think I've ever seen before, across a large number of countries. But it's still of modest scale. And so the question is whether there's an appetite within the regional development banks, the World Bank and the regional development banks, to increase their borrowing on the markets and on lending in this more traditional balance of payment support mode. Whether it's an opportunity for non-traditional donors to move more decisively and into this space. I don't know enough about what's happening, for example, in China and the what the official position in China would be. But if you look at the last few years, it would be capital from China, mainly FDI, but also loan capital. And the scope for, and perhaps we'll pick this up later, there may be scope for increased finance for reinvestment, for kind of green finance that then releases resources to the more traditional adjustment mechanisms. The other point, which we might come back to later, is whether there's scope, whether kind of crisis creates scope for effective domestic adjustment. One of the disappointing features over the last 20 odd years has been the failure to really radically improve domestic resource mobilization as part of this adjustment process. And I think there's quite a lot of discussion about whether this is an opportunity to essentially pull off the trick of widening the tax base and lowering the marginal rates in a way that allows domestic resources to be mobilized both more progressively and more efficiently than
Yeah, it's probably not sensible to go into it now, but I was struck by your slide 7, where your ODA plus reform is above the baseline. And it's better than nothing from day one. It struck me that reform, it's hard not to conclude that reform is a free lunch there, but let's perhaps leave that aside for the moment, because there's a lot of questions about debt relief, which you just mentioned. Where's Gordon Brown when you need him might be one way of paraphrasing Helen Morrissey's question. And could we could you imagine, okay, bilateral increases in bilateral aid might be difficult because every country is feeling it, but could you imagine a coordinated effort at debt relief? How might that come about? We were discussing earlier in this series, could a debt for nature or a debt for climate or debt for something swap, make it more palatable, increase the scale of debt relief, or is now not the time to be thinking about conditionalities and deals? Let's just increase the fiscal space however we can. What are your thoughts there?
No, I think this is interesting. I know the African Development Bank have been exploring sort of debt for climate type swaps. You may even be involved in that discussion. One of the challenges is that if you look to the traditional donors to many of the low-income countries, traditional creditors, official creditors, they've already written off most of their debt. That we're in an environment where the composition of borrowing over the last 5 to 7 years, maybe longer, has changed rather radically since the end of the HIPC period. So if we were having this conversation 20 years ago, it would be about what would the Paris Club be able to do? To what extent can the Paris Club coordinate the relatively small number of multilateral and bilateral donors into a coordinated debt relief and new financing rescheduling package? The Paris Club's capacity to coordinate has been significantly reduced, partly because more of the an increasing share of debt is private debt issued on markets, and an increasing share from non-Paris Club creditors. And so that doesn't mean that there isn't scope for mutually beneficial debt restructuring. That it's going to be in creditors' interests as much as the debtors' interests to think about restructuring. But it's a harder coordination problem than it might have been in the past. I think the initiatives initially raised by the G20 on the debt standstill arrangements, I think to an extent they are more relevant to emerging market countries where the share of non-concessional and private debt is higher. And so there's a lot of productive work going on there. Some of that is relevant to some of the countries in sub-Saharan Africa. There are a number of, particularly the kind of hydrocarbon-based economies that have higher levels of market debt, and there's scope for benefiting partly from the debt standstill arrangements that are being proposed by the G20. The key challenge, I guess, is how do you bring China as a major creditor into a debt restructuring discussion? What's the forum? How is that facilitated? To what extent is there the appetite in the G7 and the G20 to facilitate that? In terms of mechanisms, I suppose my initial starting point is that if ever there was a time for a kind of unconditional support, this would be it. But if some degree of conditionality were required, there's enough, a combination of conditionality and fungibility of financing still creates the scope for gains on both sides. So the debt for climate swap approach, given that there's enough leverage on the climate investment side, I'm not sure the scale of these instruments, to what extent you can use this as a mechanism to really get substantial resources into the lowest income countries. But I think that's an area that I don't know enough about, but I think it's one that you would consider pursuing.
So just about in there, you said that if ever there's a time for unconditional support, this is it. And Shivani has asked the question similarly, just from an ethical, moral standpoint, don't creditor nations, or at least the developed nations, if not also China, who has its own set of development issues to think through. But don't the rich nations at least have a moral responsibility here? I mean, it is a crisis. There are people dying, and we are able to help. Should we not?
I think it's not difficult to make the moral argument. This is a global crisis. This is not one that says it's a crisis that doesn't discriminate. It clearly does discriminate, and part of the argument here is the discrimination may be despite the best actions on the public health front, that just the spillover effects alone are so large to make it make the moral argument an important one. You could argue this on a self-interested basis, that just if you think of the, for example, European concerns about migration and what are the big drivers of migration? It's a combination of conflict, persecution, and economic hardship. And if you wanted to develop a purely self-interested argument, it would be based around concerns over migration, concerns over future markets. This is the youngest and potentially fastest growing part of the world. This is part of the rhetoric of the Global Britain strategy that the new FCO-DFID merger is articulating, that these are fast growth markets. You could make it on a purely self-interested basis. But the moral case and the moral cost benefit, I think, the cost benefit argument is going to reinforce any moral position you want to take on this.
So there's a moral case, but there's a case from self-interest as well, and let's pursue both, I suppose, is the answer. Yeah. If we go back to some of the points David was making yesterday about, you know, the Keynesian demand trap and just restoring confidence in the economy. Now, obviously, if your demand shock is external to your economy, then there's not a lot you can do. But to the extent that the demand shocks are domestic, are there not things that these countries or countries everywhere, not just in sub-Saharan Africa, can do to to get the economy restarted without necessarily having to pump money into the economy? Are there ways of, I have some in mind, you know, policies that can create confidence with investors, confidence that there will be returns, confidence that you can sink capital, create jobs, and actually that will be rewarded, that don't require trillions or hundreds or even tens of billions to get going? You simply create the confidence because you're the government.
I think that's both those parts of your statement are correct. That one of the challenges of the small open economy is that the demand shock's external. That it's not Keynesian in that sense. It's the problem about being a price taker or a global demand taker. So the kind of domestic fiscal stimulus on the demand side is A, difficult to do, and B, likely to be relatively weak for a whole variety of reasons, including the fact that some of the obvious ways in which you would do that require are based on an assumption about the scale of the formal economy. And these are, there may be some scope for simple demand, sort of income transfers and other forms of social protection that provide a bit of stimulus. But I suppose your second point goes back to your appropriate skepticism about the free lunch plot that I showed, that is sort of giving a sense of what might be achieved under what we were looking at was various forms of fiscal reform. But there is a whole agenda that in a sense pushes back against a kind of drift towards economic nationalism that is focused on, as you say, on confidence, both it's confidence towards domestic investors, but also towards external investors. I think one of the challenges, though, is that is the aggregate nature of the shock, that investing heavily in confidence in trying to get foreign investment in whatever sectors you may be thinking about, if the volume of investable funds is contracting globally, then that's always going to be quite difficult. But there's clearly an agenda of policy measures that probably are measures that you'd want to see taken in any case, but the current circumstance may raise at least the short run returns to this sort of form of improving the regulatory environment, improving kind of skills and training and the market enabling reforms, which I think is what you're hinting at, or maybe you've got something more specific in mind.
Well, I did have those in mind, and actually on that point, there's a comment I see from Mark Stanley Price about how much might be gained by tackling corruption effectively. And I guess that's true whether in sub-Saharan Africa or anywhere else in the world for that matter. But I also had in mind, you know, sets of policy instruments that guarantee or nearly guarantee returns from investments in key pieces of future-oriented infrastructure that makes them, you know, attractive to institutional investors. Now, and maybe again, as you say, that because these countries are in many instances price takers, for want of a better phrase, the impact of domestic confidence still isn't going to be big enough. And what really matters is global confidence in the global economic system. But so the policies that guarantee returns in the future, because actually as a government or as a central bank, you can, particular government, you can stand behind those returns. Yeah. I'm happy to leave that there.
In a sense, that is, that's sort of the pre-COVID agenda, in a sense, that I started by mentioning that there's quite a wide range of countries in sub-Saharan Africa that have posted very impressive returns, measurement issues notwithstanding, if you've read this week's Economist on the quality of GDP numbers in certain countries. But this agenda, I think, of thinking about policy reforms that help to attract key investors, key bits of infrastructure, the kind of market enabling public investments in smart technologies, in green technologies, in digital connectivity. That agenda, in a sense, is was quite well rooted in a fairly large number of countries. And part of my pessimistic adjustment path for domestic sort of adjustment through domestic resources only is a reflection of what happens if you have to essentially cannibalize those sorts of investments in order to try and support private consumption during the depth of the recession. So the payoff to external finance is in large part the protection of that agenda, both the resource intensive part of that agenda, the investment, but also the policy agenda. I think you're muted, Cameron.
Thanks, Chris. First time in four lectures I've managed to narrowly avoid that on a number of occasions. Thank you for picking me up. I wanted to move now to a set of issues that frequently has come up, actually, not just today, but in previous discussions as well, about the second wave, about anticipating and planning and managing around that, and also about vaccines and, you know, how we make sure that everybody has access to them, you know, and what the effects are of could be of a vaccine on various country economies. And so in particular, there's a question from Shivani again, I think, on should we be pumping money in now to a recovery when there could be a second wave around the corner? And I guess Shivani probably also means, in some sense, a major first wave in sub-Saharan African economies. And shouldn't the aim just be to keep people alive and afloat until we get this vaccine developed?
Well, I suppose, in a sense, what do lockdown and distancing and other measures do is that they, at one level, they push the spike out into the future. And one view is that they push it far enough out that a vaccine is available technically and presumably also logistically in terms of a genuine availability. And so you could say, a strategy is provide sufficient sort of consumption support, income support during that period, that transitional period, in anticipation of the recovery of a vaccine, the availability of vaccine and distribution of vaccine. On the point about whether that's an argument for not, if I understood the question correctly, for not investing today. Is that the question?
I think it was about not pushing, not stimulating the economy to the point where actually we end up with further infections and further damage. We just want to keep people alive and wait until we get a vaccine.
Right.
And so I hope I'm understanding it.
So the idea being that too rapid a recovery, in a sense, raises the risk of greater outbreak. Well, yes and no. That one thing that is, I think, quite interesting in economies where there's a large informal sector, where economic activity is in some sense very intimate, it's not clear even now whether lockdown and social distancing measures are particularly effective. Extreme lockdown, definitely in those areas where there's density, and the evidence coming out of evidence from Kenya, really very interesting in terms of what seems to be happening as a result of lockdown policies in areas that you might have thought were highly vulnerable to the spread of infection.
So, Chris, sorry to interrupt you there. I mean, you weren't saying that lockdown and social distancing aren't effective and shouldn't be policy, were you? Or is that what you're kind of driving at? Maybe we should...
I'm saying that it's not clear. They are very costly policies in terms of the disruption.
Right.
And I think we've got a very unclear view as yet on their efficacy.
Okay. So it's a cost versus benefit question.
Yeah. So I think that remains a very difficult balance to strike. But to try and get back to the kind of core point, we're not really talking about stimulating economies here. We're talking about mitigating the negative of that. And even if, as for example is the case in Uganda, the lockdown is almost completely removed. That's only removing one part of the shock that we're looking at. That it's a lot of what I'm talking about here is how to deal with the external element of the shock, and in a sense, it doesn't really matter what's happening on the public health side. That external spillover effect is still hugely damaging to lives and livelihoods, both present and future. But the only other point I'd make on this is that it's where I started, that it may well be that the biggest threat on the health and welfare side of the ledger comes from the indirect effects, the fact that other aspects of public expenditure have been cut back, that immunization programs have been scaled back, that people are not seeking health or treatment on malaria or on non-communicable diseases, and that the combination of that and reduction in schooling and all the associated effects, indirect effects, are the ones that are going to really damage the recovery process. And if that is the case, then I can see no argument why you wouldn't, even if you anticipated the wave increasing or a second wave, why you wouldn't look to try and minimize the short run impact on these economies today.
Okay, we're starting to run out of time, but I'd like to get your insights. Actually, I might just add that you've, I think indirectly, at least partially answered John Rosenfield's Field's question in your last response about whether macroeconomic adjustments are much of a function of healthcare responses or not. And at least as far as these indirect effects go, you're saying, you know, it's related, but actually the indirect effects are there irrespective of how well you have a response. But I'd like to move to a separate issue around currencies and monetary questions. Mm-hmm. Now, there's a couple of questions here that kind of can be joined together. Tony Cole has asked a question about the US dollar as a base currency. And if we moved away from that, perhaps adopting some other currency or unitary currency, could that help? John Rosenfield has asked, are there bright areas of investment in sub-Saharan Africa? Are there regional differences here? Are there reasons for optimism? Mm-hmm. And I'd like to put those two points together and ask my own question, if I may. Yeah. A nation state's ability to respond here is presumably partly a function of how under control or otherwise inflation is. Yeah. Because if inflation is under control and inflationary expectations are damped, then you know there's a certain amount of printing of money that you can engage with and monetary financing of deficits that enables you to respond. Yeah. And I'm no expert on African countries, but I'm well aware that they're not all the same as one another. And some countries have more fiscal space, more challenges with inflation than others. And perhaps you could give us a sense in your answer, both at this kind of macro level, do we shift away from the US dollar, but also at the more regional nation state level, are there areas to think, well, actually, you know, here's a half dozen countries, they might be in sub-Saharan Africa, but the macroeconomic arrangements are not too shabby. Inflation's under control. They've got some space here to go and print. What do you think?
Well, yes, let me start in reverse order with this sort of fiscal space and capacity for a kind of what you might call sort of unconventional monetary policy elsewhere. There is some scope for that, but and if I were to look at countries that have kind of established a degree of kind of fiscal control and macroeconomic management on which you could build that kind of response, for in some sense this has always been the glittering prize in monetary policy reform, is to create the space to respond to real shocks when real shocks hit. And I could think of maybe four or five key countries, there may well be more, that option is there. Ghana, Ethiopia, Rwanda, Kenya, probably Uganda, possibly Tanzania in that group as well. There's also this really interesting group in West Africa that operate the CFA franc that is underpinned by the French Treasury. If ever there was an opportunity for that underwriting guarantee to be put to good use, it would be in the franc zone at the moment. Interestingly, it's only 2 or 3 months ago that the franc zone took a very decisive move to try and weaken that link. But if you were looking for an opportunity to take advantage of that institutional arrangement, there's 14 countries in West and Central Africa that have that option.
That's very interesting. Can I just to dive in a little bit further on that? Who would need to take action to make that happen?
That would require a coordinated view within the zone, i.e. between the two central banks representing the countries of West and Central Africa, and to some extent the government of France to gently turn a blind eye. And these countries enjoy full convertibility and, in a sense, the option of monetary financing if their overdraft of the French Treasury is allowed to increase. And that's given that the franc zone as a whole is about the size of a medium-sized département in France. That's not a big thing to do. And that may well be happening, but there's an interesting opportunity there, certainly for those countries. As I say, I think there are other countries where this is there's some scope, but these are not terribly highly monetized economies. You don't have large banking systems, you don't have huge penetration that allows the leverage from monetary financing to be particularly significant. The two other points, I do think there are important kind of potential growth areas. As with elsewhere in the world, this crisis has given a huge kick to digital technologies and kind of teleworking, and countries like Kenya, Rwanda to a large extent, places that have time zone advantage, have got well-educated workforces, especially well-educated English-speaking workforces, are capturing quite a bit of the market in back office services and that kind of. It's not highly labor intensive, but it's a growth area. Regional trade is the other issue. I think one of the consequences of the global demand shock is that creates the incentives for increased intra-regional trade. And that will start to build on quite heavy investment, both in the policy and the physical infrastructure that has supported quite substantial growth in intra-regional trade over the last decade. I think that's going to enjoy a fillip. I think we will see a substitution away from global imports into regional imports. So there is a kind of a regional Keynesian opportunity there, even if we're seeing a decline in demand
Now we're very nearly out of time, a minute left. Vishnu has been patiently waiting, having asked the first question of the whole session, and I've left it right till the end. So apologies, Vishnu, thank you for your patience. But he's asked, will the paradigm environmental economics be redrawn? Now, I'm going to interpret that a little bit for you, Chris. I'm going to suggest that what he's interested in, I hope I'm right about this, is whether this is an opportunity, the pandemic is an opportunity for the countries of sub-Saharan Africa to think a little bit about their development model, their economic model, and look perhaps at some of the mistakes that we have made in richer economies and to rethink the paradigm, as it were, and to build back better, to build back or to build forward differently and more greenly, perhaps. Obviously, we have a paper, me and co-authors, I and my co-authors in the issue, on this issue. But I'm wondering about your thoughts, how it would apply to the developing context.
Well, I think there are opportunities. And in a sense, this picks up strands that we're seeing already in the in all the debate around resilient infrastructure investments and climate responsive public investment programs. And I think that's going to accelerate. There are clearly some technological leapfrogging areas, digital technology, mobile banking, different approaches to financial sector development. I think one of the really big areas is the thing that I mentioned on the previous question. I think we may see this as generating a substantial change in patterns of trade from extra regional or extra continental trade with traditional metropolitan sort of commodities for manufactured goods to greater incentives for domestic trade. And that as markets grow, as the continent becomes more urbanized, that's a whole another set of issues, but the rapid growth and the growth of markets and the investment in the infrastructure of trade, I think intra-regional trade is probably going to be quite an important part of a recovery strategy. Does that amount to a change in paradigm? I'm not sure. But I think it may be an important part of the recovery strategy.
Great. Well, thank you very much, Chris. And that's all we've got time for in terms of the substance of the discussion today. This particular issue of the Oxford Review of Economic Policy will be published, I think, within the next week, if not even sooner. Some of the articles are up online already as advanced articles. I've just asked myself a question in the question box. I'm not sure if anybody else can see that, but it's on it, the Oxrep website at OUP, and Chris and others' papers will be fully published within, within a week or so. There are existing papers up there, including Gordon Brown, Joe Stiglitz, and various others. Actually, it's a very good issue. We have further talks building on this issue coming up. On the 16th of September, Maria Del Rio and Shannon and Don Farmer will be talking about the impact of supply and demand shocks on industry and occupations. And on the 13th of October, Mariana Mazzucato will be talking about the big failure of small government. And we hope as well in due course, sometime within September or October, to have Yulia Giese from the Bank of England discussing her paper. But for now, and indeed for the next month, that's it from us at the Oxford Martin School, the Smith School, and the Oxford Review of Economic Policy. Thank you for tuning in, and please come back after a well-deserved, I hope, holiday, certainly on our accounts, well-deserved, on the 16th of September. Thank you very much.
Thank you.